of Al-Anon.
I
make at least 2 Al-Anon meetings a week and sometimes a third. I'd like to say thank you for the committee for asking me. I always thought when I saw wild and wonderful West Virginia that the people were wild. I never... But on my way up here, I realized that when you take the personalities out and look at the principles, it is wild and it is wonderful. And as we were coming over the mountains, I thought, if only God can make a tree, he's been mighty busy in West Virginia. I want to thank AA for several things. First, because they shared with us their 12 steps, their 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts. And I was nervous, and I'm nervous now. If you all can't tell, I can. And when she read the concepts, I was very much at home. Thank you for that. Thank you all. I want to thank AA because I can say I'm the mother of, first the wife of, and the mother of 2 recovering alcoholics. And to me, that's pretty wonderful, and I thank you. Because they told me to turn them over to AA, and they take care of them. And I trusted enough to do this. Because it was a full-time job taking care of me. I didn't know that when I got here. My story is like everybody else's, and you've heard part of it this weekend. And I don't know whether this is such a good spot to be in or not, because everybody told a little bit of my story. We're all alike in one sense of the word. So all I have is my story and what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I was born in New England, and you never guessed that with you all. I was born in Scituate, Rhode Island, the smallest of 48 then. I was born in the country. My mother and father had 9 children, and I'm right in the middle, and I have a red-headed twin sister. And if you think I'm a ticket, you ought to see the two of us together. We're nothing alike. She's red-headed. We don't look alike. We don't act alike. I've been too independent almost, and she's always been a totally dependent person, so we're 2 very different personalities. My grandmother had 18 children, and the doors were always open. I told you it was a long time ago. See, I keep on. I'll tell you how old I am. And the doors were never locked, and you never knew when you got up in the morning how many was going to be sitting at the breakfast table. It could be 14, it could be 16, it could be 4. And to me, it was a happy childhood. There wasn't a lot of material. We lived more or less off the land, and we learned to take care of ourselves, to be independent, and to make our own entertainment. And there was always a crowd at our house. Well, my father, since I was a twin, my father was a finished carpenter. And if you don't know what that is, he finishes the inside of houses. And he would take me to work with him. People did that in those days. And he'd take me to work with him, and he'd give me a 2x4 and drive some nails in. And it was my job to take them out and drive them back. And when he went by, he'd take the nails out. Consequently, before I ever went to school, I could drive nails and saw boards. And I liked this. And if I got really bored, he'd give me a ball of string and some stakes, and he'd say, go lay me out a house. And I'd lay out the foundation of a house, and when he got through, he always took time to say, and what is this? And is this over here a bedroom? And he always took time to see what I was doing. I got a lot of good things from my father. He never met a stranger, and I've never met very many. They're just friends I haven't met yet. And I also picked up some character defects, because you have to take the bitter with the better. And he was a very stubborn person, and he was very prideful. And I took this too. And later on, as I got in Al-Anon, I learned to deal with these character defects as well. Well, it was a good life. He taught us to square dance. I could square dance before I ever went to school. I could cook before I ever went to school. And he told my mother to let me sew on that sewing machine of hers, which she didn't want broken, and I can understand that today. But he said, if she messes it up, I'll get you another, and he would have. And I was putting quilts together before I ever went to school, doll baby quilts before I ever went to school. when you had to put the pattern board, the pattern box on top of the treadle because my feet were too short. So consequently, today I make all my own clothes and just do it all. Well, when the war broke out, this family was scattered in all directions. I mean World War II. I heard a snicker down here and I was afraid she thought it wasn't meant at home. No, it was World War II, and things changed, and they changed in a hurry. The boys all went in service, my brother-in-laws went in service, and life became something totally different. In 1944, I met a sailor. We moved to the city. My father had a defense job, and he was one of these people that did not have a lot of formal education, but he could look at a pile of lumber and tell you exactly how many feet was in it. And he was self-taught, and the new math he taught me when I was little. You had the whole numbers, and then you had the little ones. And I could do this boy early, tie knots and all those good things. But World War II came along, and all of this went out the window. Life changed, and it changed in a hurry. And I met the cutest little sailor in Providence, Rhode Island, and he was black-headed and black-eyed, and he was special. And I met him at the Y, and he was breaking two rules. One of them, he came in the Y drinking. He wasn't supposed to. And I took him home to get him straight so he wouldn't miss the ship. Now, does that tell you something about me? I started caretaking, and I've been caretaking most ever since. I'm not as bad as I was, but I was there. In 1946, we moved to Virginia. His dad went blind through eye problems and had surgery, and he was blind, legally blind. So we moved to Virginia to be close to his mother and his family. Well, this was a whole new ball game for me. People stayed to themselves. I lost friends. I left my family, and I was sort of in isolation. And he had a good job, and I didn't have to go to work. We had two children, 13 months apart, two boys, and I decided that I was going to have to go to work to be near people. Because I have to have people. I'm sorry. People are part of me. And I went to work, and I guess the good Lord was looking out for me when I didn't have sense enough to look out for myself, because this was my estate. And at least I was out of the situation for a little bit. And this job became very important as time went on. It saved my sanity. It really did. And four sons later, we had two more in 10 years. And I had four boys. And we were involved in the church. And these four boys, the two oldest ones, sang in the church choir. And I taught Sunday school. And from the outside, we looked great. Well, somewhere along the line, I lost my identity. I had a good job. I have four boys. And I became the boy's mother and his wife. I had the job, but I was a nobody. And I thought one day I was running the vacuum cleaner. And we had since gotten away from church because he started staying away from church, going to the bootleggers and picking us up in the crowded street in front of church. And this was the depths of degradation as far as I was concerned. And you know what happens. We sort of back up, and that's what happened. So I was running the vacuum cleaner this day, and I thought, you know, it's not right for someone with four boys and a husband to be this lonely. And it suddenly came to me that I was never alone. All I had to do was reach out, and God would put his hand in mine. And this is the thing that kept me sane through the depths of alcoholism. Well, his friends would say, if I had to live with her, I'd drink too. My friends would say, well, why don't you move out? But not one ever said, said, pack up those four boys and move in with me. They just didn't do it. People ask me, well, why did you stay? Basically, I loved him. And basically, I was raised that way. And I guess that's why I stayed, even though it took me to the depths. But to just share a couple of experiences, and I'm going to move on. One night I came in, and I was working 4:30 to 2. I have four little boys, and I ironed, at that time in my life, we ironed clothes, and it was about 70 shirts a week. And I was tired. And I came in at 2 o'clock in the morning, and as he's still up drinking. Anytime I rounded the corner, if the lights was on, it was one of two things. Who was Stephen which? Was he babysitting the boys, or were the boys babysitting him? And you never knew when you rounded that corner, if the lights was on, just what was happening. Well, this night, I came in, and he was up. So I decided, well, there's one way to fix this. I'll just get me a wiffle bat, and I'll knock him out. So I went in the closet in the boys' room, and I was scrounging around, and one of these boys woke up, and he said, Mama, what are you looking for? And I said, I'm looking for the wiffle bat. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to knock your dad out. And he said, Mom, if you're going to do that, get the ball bat. Then he said, Mama, let me see what I can do. So he went in, he talked to his dad, he said, Dad, come on in here with me. And he coaxed him into the bedroom. The child set him on the bed, took his shoes off, leaned him back, and he talked to him. First thing you know, he covered him up, went in the closet, got a blanket, went on the couch, and everything was fine. That child was more in control of the situation than his mom. And later I see this child looking up at me, and I'm ranting and raving like something wild. And he said, Mama, I know what's wrong with Dad. He's drunk. But what in the world is wrong with you? And I could see this image in these tears running down his cheek. And when I got in this program and they talked about, do we affect the lives of our children? I could look back at that and I knew it. Well, and then there came a time when I was going to hide the kids in a cornfield. The cornfield was behind the house, and he was sort of wild, and he decided to leave, and he pulled out drawers, and he packed his suitcase, and he left. Well, Mom, you know, taking care of everybody, justifying it all the way, said, I'll sleep a big one with a little one. We'll sleep with our shoes on. If your daddy comes back and he's rowdy, you can sneak out the back door, hide in the cornfield. I'll get the car, and I'll go around the street, and I'll pick you up around the street. He came in at 4 o'clock and knocked on the door, and I locked up, which was unusual. And I said, well, what do you want? I thought you left. He said, I did, but I forgot my medicine. I said, well, come on in. And he said, I feel so bad. I said, well, maybe if you get in the bed and go to sleep, you'd feel better. And that's exactly what he did. But look what I did to those kids. I terrified them. And I remembered this. Well, then there was a Thanksgiving. He took the boys to the ball game, and it was the daytime, and it was a natural bowl in Petersburg. And some of his friends, he got drunk, and the four boys were loose, and somebody hitched him to a cyclone fence. Threw his belt on some of his buddies, because they couldn't keep up with him either. And it was a terrible day. And to top it all off, my mother and dad had decided to come from Rhode Island, and of course I didn't tell them what was going on. You know, so I had three generations, and he decided this is a good day to take my life. So he gets out the shotgun, and we wrestle with the shotgun, and finally I handed the shotgun to him, and I said, look, nothing else seems to make you happy, and if this pleases you, help yourself. And I handed him a loaded shotgun. He put the gun under his chin, pulled both triggers at the same time, and the gun jammed. Well, he went to bed, but I didn't. And for the next 3 years, and 3 years into Al-Anon, my wheels, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I'd see the bubblegum machine and the police car, and I'd say, it's my fault. I'm in jail for giving them the gun. I knew it was loaded. And now the kids have neither mother or father, and I could blow this way out. And Al-Anon showed me how to free myself of this. Well, I didn't know where I was going or what was doing, and one morning I woke up, and he was banging on the wall asking for help. And I decided this was the time to go get some help. I know that if they ask for it, they're better off, and I'm not sure that he wouldn't have been better off, but nevertheless, this is the way it happened, and I went looking for some help the next morning. And sometime before, while my mother and dad were there, my dad had a health problem, and I went to the drugstore, and he was following me in the drugstore on Saturday morning crying, and the druggist said to me, "Louise, do you know there is a doctor in town who works with people like your husband?" Now, remember, this was before it was all over TV. This was 1963. And it wasn't on TV. You didn't read it in magazines. And he dropped this, but I was too busy. I was too into what I was doing to pick up on this. So when I went for help, I went to the minister of the church where I was, where the boys and I and Jean had gone. And when I got in there, I unfolded my tale of woe. And he stood in the middle of floor and shook. And I said, "Oh my goodness. Now if he has a heart attack, that's my fault too." And I literally fell apart. But he said, "I don't know what to do." And I said, "Well, I heard there was a doctor in town. See that seed that had been planted? And it came forth." And he said, "Well, that's easy." He picked up the phone, called, and miracles began to happen. The doctor was in town. It was Saturday morning. And said, "Send her down to me and I'll talk to her." So I went to the doctor's office like a zombie. Hardly knew whether I'd eaten. I don't know to this day whether I had eaten that day or anything else. I landed in the doctor's office, and he walked by me, and he patted me on the head, and he said, "Honey, all wives think they're responsible, and it's okay." And I thought, this man understands what I'm going through. Well, things began to happen, and he made the 12-step call, and Jean came to the house. And of course, he came behind me in his car, and I ran in the bathroom so I wouldn't get in a problem before he got there. To show you the disarray, one of the boys had a bowl of soup watching a ball game in the middle of the living room on a kitchen stool. And he came in and took over, and he sent the boy back to the kitchen with a bowl of soup, reached over, cut the TV off. And I wouldn't dare cut a TV off in that house, not when he was looking at a ball game. Dare, and he did it. And to make a long story short, he landed in AA. He was sent to the hospital, and he stayed the weekend, because then you didn't admit it for alcoholism. He had bronchitis, and he went to the hospital for bronchitis. And he said, "Louise, I will treat him, but you must go to Al-Anon." So I was sentenced to Al-Anon by a doctor. I didn't make a mistake. I was sentenced here. The closest Al-Anon meeting was 23 miles away. And was I not only bankrupt mentally, physically, and spiritually, but financially, it took 7 years to get out of debt. So I know what it is to come in Al-Anon and be broke. But God, you know, they taught me in the Lord's Prayer that give me this day my daily bread. And all of my bread has been met. But I walked in my first Al-Anon meeting. I drove 23 miles. He was in the hospital over there. And they brought them down to 210 North Madison Street in Richmond. And that's where the Al-Anon meeting was out of. We met at the club and moved over to the Dyson building and had a meeting over there. And I walked in that meeting and I was scared to death. I guess I weighed 99 pounds soaking wet. I was scared. If you looked at me cross, I cried, but I didn't know why. That's the way I landed at Al-Anon. And I walked in that meeting, and these girls was 8 or 10 sitting around a table, and they were all smiling. I didn't know whether I was going to a Salvation Army, greet the drum deal, or just what was going to happen to me, and I was petrified. And I walked in, and they were all smiling. I said, "No way, they couldn't have the problems I've got. No way, because they wouldn't be smiling if they did." But I carried away that from that very first Al-Anon meeting, three very important things. If they could do it, I could do it. And they said alcoholism was an illness. I didn't cause it. I was not responsible for it, no more than I would be if he had pneumonia. And I said, I can't believe this. Well, they also told me something else, that I could live my life one day at a time. I could break it down into manageable bits. Yesterday was gone, tomorrow's not here, and all I had to deal with was today. And if I take the day 2 hours at a time, make it to lunch, then I could make it till I got off from work or whatever. But this, and this I liked. I left with just for today, the little pamphlet, and I carried it home with me, and I carried it to work in my uniform pocket. I carried it in my pajama pocket when I went to sleep, and it became a part of me. But this wise doctor made me do another thing. He made me go to work and tell my superintendent, and this company had 7,000 employees, and I told him I was scared to death. And he said, you must go to work and tell them what is wrong with you. Well, shucks, there wasn't anything wrong with me. He's the guy with the problem. And if they get him straightened out, everything would be fine. Well, he was a wise man. And he sent me to work. And I had one supervisor that knew what was going on. My attitude was, if he's stupid enough to drink, and I'm stupid enough to live with him, I'm sure not going to tell anyone. So I kept it all bottled inside me. And when I went that day, I went in and found a supervisor who caught me one time crying. I was talking to the man across the street. And I left home, Gene was threatening suicide, and I left four boys with him. And those kind of people don't make good employees. And I was standing there crying, and he walked by, and when he got me to myself, he came over and asked me, was everything okay? And I shared just a little bit with him that I had left Gene with these four boys. So he said, and I walked in that day and I said, Gilbert, this is what I have to do, but I can't do it. He said, yes, you can, honey. I'll help you. And he took me by the arm, went over, picked up the telephone, called upstairs the office. And I said, but Gilbert, the shifts are changing. This big superintendent and the supervisors from both shifts. I can't do that. He said, yes, you can. I'll help you. And he took me to that office and set me in the door. And I had to share that I need to go on daylight for 30 days to get the problem at home straightened out. And I went back to work. But my assistant superintendent, who taught a couple of my boys at school, said, came up later in the evening, and he put his arm on my shoulder and he said, do you know that we've been trying to figure out what was wrong with you for 7 years? This is how long I had buried all of this. Then I did something else. I figured if this thing was coming out of the out from under the rug, and if he had pneumonia, I'd take these boys to the hospital, see their dad. So I dressed these four boys up in their Sunday best, and I took them to MCV, Medical College of Virginia, to see their dad on Sunday. And he was humiliated. How dare me bring these boys to an alcoholic unit? It's the best thing I ever did. It swept alcoholism out from underneath the rug and put it out where it belonged. And I carried it one step farther. While he was in a hospital, I went to school. And I told their teachers what was wrong with them, or us. And they said, thank God, now we know what to do with these boys. And one was, the oldest one was 15, and the littlest one was 5. So we still wasn't out of the woods by a long shot. Well, I made up my mind that I was going to Al-Anon, and for the next 7 years, I missed two Tuesday nights and getting to Richmond, some 23 miles away. We started a group sooner than that in Petersburg, but this was where my growth came from, was Richmond, and I still went. And things got better. And they told me, you know, it's when you drag yesterday, throw it on today, borrow from tomorrow, put that on today, roll it all up, you mess up today. And I believe that today. I do that. If I can stay in today, I can make it. Well, I picked up two sponsors. I started out with two sponsors. One was a minister's wife, and she'd say, come on, honey, things are not that bad. And the other one would say, now you know it, damn it, do something about it. And one would push me down, the other one pull me up. And I was like a yo-yo, but it gave me balance. And these girls were busy in service work. And the first thing I did was make some amends. The first step I ever made was making amends. Now, I did it as I saw it. And the first thing I made amends to was with my children. Because I could see those tears running down that boy's face. And I said, there is no pills, no anything I can take. But I can go to Al-Anon, get my life straightened out. And if the bad things of alcoholism come and rub off on them, then the good things I hear in the program can also rub off on them. And this is how I made amends to those children. That's the first amends I made. And I... I nearly got fired from this job. And I thought, if they can give me a second chance, I'm going to be the best employee they have. And if I was a floor sweeper, I was going to be the best. If I was a high-powered machine operator, that's what I was going to be, and I was going to do the very best I could, one day at a time. And that's what I did. And this program is based on attraction rather than promotion. And somewhere down the line, this paid off. People would walk up to me and say, what happened to you? You used to be so stuck up. I wasn't stuck up. I was scared to death, and I was hiding behind myself. Well, it ended up a very good job. I picked up another sponsor in service. I went to a meeting one time, and this nice-looking woman, all dressed up and looked so good, and I thought, gee, I'd like to be like that one day. And do you know, she became my sponsor, and she was 150 miles away. So I had three. And this one, I would get a note in the mail, and I'd shake it out, and a little piece of paper might fall on the table, and it would say, God loves you because he's good, not because you're good. Can you imagine that? He loves me because he's good. I don't have to be good. He still loves me. Well, service did for me a lot of things. I spent time with winners, and I learned that this program was a program of self-discovery. I have a problem with 12-step self-help group. I couldn't help myself. People like you reached out and held my hand till I got 2 feet on the ground and could help myself. But they loved me this way. And it was through the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts that I grew. I made my first international in 19... And then suddenly one day I realized, well, maybe I ought to do it for me. So I decided the way I would handle this, I didn't have but two pair of shoes. So I would get on my knees and put the shoe I was going to wear the next morning all the way under the bed. And say, God, thank you for this day. And when I got up in the morning, in order to put that shoe on, I had to get back to those knees, and I'd reach under there and pull it out and say, go with me today. Well, we went through a 9-month dry drunk that was pure hell. It was. But I must tell you that one of these sponsors decided I needed to take an inventory. So she started me out writing it on paper, and the first thing we put on this paper was fear. And I went back as far as I could remember at the things I was fearful of. And the first two items I wrote on there have nothing to do with alcoholism whatsoever. It was fear of thunderstorms and fear of death. And when I sat down with her and talked this over, she realized, and I realized, where my fear of the threat of suicide came from. And I stood at my grandfather's bed, at the foot of his bed when he died, and I was 5 years old. And I had a baby brother die in my mother's arms when he was 9 months old, and I was hanging on my father's coattail. Well, I never got through this, but I never realized that that's where the problem was coming from. And once I talked it over, excuse me, and realized where, I'm okay. Once I realized where it was coming from, it didn't hurt anymore. And we sat down and talked about it. And during this period of time, when this 9 months, when it was so hard, I wanted to go to Blackstone to see this particular sponsor. And this was a spiritual weekend and had no money. And I said, okay, God, if you mean to be for me to be there, then you show me the way. And this was on a Monday. Thursday, I got a check in the mail for a deposit on a gas meter 15 years before. I get to Blackstone, and she's not there. And I went to the pits. And this nice-looking woman walked up to me and said, are you Louise? And I said, yes, I am. And she said, I'm Marcy, and I'm from Texas. And Dee from Roanoke called me and said, we needed to chat. And Marcy had just gone through what I had gone through, or what I was going through. And that, I believe, is another one of God's miracles. Well, I went home, and this was better, but we still had a crisis going on. So we ended up at MCV, and he saw the doctor that I called, and he said, you all come on over here. So we went over there. He talked to the doctor. I took to a social worker. The social worker told me that I didn't need these friends and that I ought to stay home and take care of my husband. And I ended up 110% wrong or more. And thank God they're not like that today. But as we come across the Lee Bridge, I had 7 cents in my pocket. And he told me, he said, well, I only see one thing to do. He said, I'll just go and take my life, and then you'll have the insurance, and you'll have the boys, and everything will be okay. And I said, pull up to the curb. We're on the Lee Bridge. I have 7 cents in my pocket. And he said, what do you want to do that for? I said, well, I'm getting out. He said, what are you getting out for? 10 o'clock at night? And I said, yeah, if you can take your life, what difference does it make? I said, but do me two favors. And he said, what's that? Don't scare the kids to death. And if you're going to make a mess, get down in the woods. God with those kids. I didn't have to be with them. I trusted that God would take care of them. And he did. But you know, he didn't let me out of the car. And I never have, to this day, heard any more about suicide. That was the end of it. The weapon was no longer a weapon because I worked my way through it. Well, I got to move on here. I was elected delegate in 74, 5, and 6, and I thought that was the greatest thing that could ever happen to anyone. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I flew on an airplane for the very first time in my life. This company that I worked for, that I went up to high school, and they said, Louise, remember now, I was married in 1944. I was 18, he was 19. I left in my senior year of high school. And I went to school where these boys were in high school, and they said, Louise, come back here, take your GED. These kids are going to have more education than you got. I went back to school, got my GED first time around. Al-Anon had educated me. I knew words like anonymity and what they meant, you know? And I passed this thing on my first go-round. The company thought enough of me to send me to school, and I picked up 28 college credits. And they paid for them. For that, I'm grateful. This is the same company that I nearly got fired from. But see, my change of attitude did all of that. Well, you think, well, things cannot get any better, but they did. And in 1986, I had just retired, and I was working blood banks for American Red Cross, setting up blood banks. And I decided this is a good time to give blood. 3 12-hour shifts. I told you I was a doer and a shaker. I worked 3 shifts, 12 hours a day. The last day I decided to give blood, and a doctor was drawing it, or doing the testing, and he said, "Louise, you need to see a doctor." I said, "For what?" He said, "Your hemoglobin is real low." So I made the rest of my shift, and the last thing he said was, "You see a doctor." The next night, it was New Year's holiday. There wasn't anybody in their office or anything. So I made it till Monday, and Tuesday was the first day back in the office. And there was a nurse in the Al-Anon group, and she looked at me and she said, "Louise, what's wrong with you?" And I shared with her what was going on. After the meeting, she said, "I'm going to call you tomorrow. Make sure you went to that doctor." And I did. I went to the doctor. The same doctor sent me to Al-Anon. And in 2 hours' time, I was in the hospital. They thought I had leukemia. And they run all kinds of tests. And here I am, sitting up in there. And because of this, I had erratic heartbeat, so they put a monitor on that. And that, there was about 5 doctors working on me from A to Z and back again. And I kept saying, "But I don't have it. I know I don't have leukemia." They said, "How do you know?" I said, "Because God doesn't take you to this height and drop you." Somebody asked me to put my name in as a trustee, and I had done that. And it had gone through the process, and I was supposed to be in Connecticut for an interview with the board for a trustee. And I knew God didn't carry me this far and drop me. I just knew it. And I had a friend that had leukemia, and I sat at her feet when she was dying, and I said, "DB, what does it feel like?" And she said, "Well, if it hurts to raise your little finger, you got some idea what the pain is like." I had none of this. Well, make a long story short, I took the test. I got out of the hospital. They couldn't find a thing wrong. They gave me 2 units of blood, plasma at that. And then I had to go back for a checkup on Wednesday. That was leaving Friday for my interview from the board. And the girls kept saying at the hospital, "Oh, go on, call him up. He'll get the report right here in the hospital." So no, I went back to his office. And we gathered around his telephone, he and his nurses, and he made the call. And when it came back, they said, "No, she couldn't possibly have leukemia." So there you are, another miracle in my life. And I went to New York, or Stamford, Connecticut, and I was walking in the clouds. I think it was as close as I have been to the God of my understanding. But I knew deep down that I did not have leukemia. Well, 2 years ago, I was elected as a trustee. And and I want to tell you something. This is the fellowship of equals. I am no better than any one of you. This is a fellowship of equals, and they used to tell me it didn't matter if you came from jail or Yale. We're all in there together. And he didn't say carry the message to anyone. He said to everyone. And that's the way I look at it. It's service, but it's at a different level. If you're cleaning up coffee cups, you're just as important to this Al-Anon program as I am. It's just service at another level. Well, I thought that is the height. I couldn't go any higher. And then 2 years ago, I had the privilege of chairing the international meeting. in Stamford, Connecticut, 24 countries around the world. And I heard the Serenity Prayer said in all these languages. It was a wonderful mountaintop experience. And we did unanswered questions, and you wrote your question, and everyone left there with the questions answered. Japan, Australia, China. And we took time to sit with them at dinner and talk through whatever they might have. And it was a mountaintop experience. And when we came to the evaluations, there was one negative comment. You know what that was? The air conditioner was too cold. Can you imagine it? Well, I have the privilege of leaving on the 17th of August for the International in Brussels, Belgium. So I'm going to Brussels. As part of all of you. And I want to tell you that everything I am, oh, I forgot a point. When I get back from Brussels, Jean and I celebrate 50 years of being married. And the boys say, Mama, this only happens to some people sometimes, and they have gone wild. They have gone wild. And I'm grateful. But the neatest thing is, everything I am and everything I ever hope to be, everything I have, I owe to people like you, every one of you sitting here today, because you reached out and held my hand and loved me when I was unlovable. And I want to say thank you. And there's a little prayer that says, thank you, God, for all you've given me, for all you've taken away, and for all you've left me. God bless.